Targeted by a system of white supremacy, whether in anti-black racism, Islamophobia, or xenophobia. Remember the raids taking place around the United States, targeting migrants, whether in New York City, Tucson, Arizona. And so we also stand in solidarity with them.
Witness Against Torture and other human rights activists demand in front of the White House that President Obama keep his promise to close the Guantanamo Bay prison and end torture. Also, Why We Fight, authors and artists of a new book about resistance, visit the nation's capital. All that and more coming up.
Welcome to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition for January 14, 2016. I'm Esther Averam. Well, on this week when President Obama delivered his final State of the Union address on Tuesday, we went outside the White House where the cry was shut it down, meaning shut down the U.S.-run Guantanamo Bay prison, site of indefinite detention and torture. Then we went to the Brooklyn neighborhood to hear authors and artists of a new book, When We Fight, We Win, 21st Century Movements and the Activists That Are Transforming Our World. We'll hear those voices in the second half of the show. As always, we've packed as much as we can in this less than an hour, starting with some headlines and side eye on the election. Well, the second Reclaim MLK weekend is filled to the brim here in the DMV. The AFL-CIO's Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Civil and Human Rights Conference will be held starting tomorrow, Friday, January 15th through Monday, January 18th. For more information, go to aflcio.org. The Stop Police Terror Project, 1DC, BYP 100, and Black Lives Matter DMV is sponsoring hashtag Muriel Gotta Go-Go, a go-go civil disobedience on Saturday, January 16th from 6:30 p.m. On at 14th and U Streets Northwest in front of the Reeve Center. Organizers say we're going to turn up to tell Muriel Bowser she gotta go-go. The second annual Jazz and Freedom Festival, a multi-generational musical marathon and benefit concert benefiting Black Lives Matter, happens this Sunday beginning at 4 p.m. at Union Arts, 411 New York Avenue. More information is at capitalbop.com. And on Monday, the 10th annual MLK Peace Walk and Parade will be held January 18th, this Monday, 9:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. The assembly for the Peace Walk will begin at 9:30 a.m. at Bethlehem Baptist Church Lot, 2498 Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue in Southeast. And the parade will assemble at 11 a.m. at St. Elizabeth's East, 2700 Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue, Southeast. Now, last night, the $50 billion Empowerment Tour presented by New York Life and the Empowerment Experiment Foundation came to Howard University, and this is an effort touted to create $50 billion in black wealth and 1 million jobs. For more information, go to theempowermenttour.com. As the Maryland General Assembly opens, a broad coalition of activists is organizing to end Maryland's so-called Police Officers Bill of Rights, which grants police in the state virtual impunity in incidents when they brutalize or kill people. And those activists will be lobbying and visiting the General Assembly to support legislation to end this so-called Police Officers Bill of Rights. And the updated information for the Washington, D.C. Memorial Services for Dr. Franz Kress Welsing as follows. I believe there is a service today at Howard University, and then the memorial service will be on Saturday, January 23rd from 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. at Metropolitan AME Church, 1518 M Street. And the memorial service will be live streamed and live broadcast here at WPFW 89.3 FM. The 40th Day Ascension Rites Ceremony will be Thursday, February 11th, 2016 at Union Temple Baptist Church, 2025 W Street Southeast, and that time to be announced. Now, the date and place for the UN Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent coming here to the DMV, coming here to DC has been set. The town hall meeting will be held on Wednesday, January 27th, beginning at 6:30 p.m. at Union Temple also. The Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent is a United Nations body of independent experts dedicated to improving the human rights situation of the Black diaspora. And that working group will be in the U.S. Starting January 19th to the 29th to examine in detail the situation of Black people in the U.S., identify problems, and make recommendations for solutions. For more information about the town hall that will be on January 27th at Union Temple, contact the Pan-African Community Action Organization at pacaprotonmail.com or call 202-787-5229. And those are our headlines and happenings. And now we're going to go right to side eye on the election. Our expert analysts Jamila Bay and Amy Alexander are in the house here to provide unvarnished analysis. Let's jump right in, Jamila. How you doing?
Well, how are you? It's always my delight to be here with you and Amy. But Esther, I'm sad. You know, I've been looking for things to put into my side-eye gratitude journal, and despite being 2 weeks into the new year, I'm struggling to come up with more than just one. But I'll save the best for last and just hint that it's got something to do with the mail. But first, as we mentioned earlier, this Tuesday, President Barack Obama delivered his final State of the Union address, and he hinted that it would be something different and a swaggerlicious. Can I say that about POTUS?
Well, yes.
I guess I just did. a confident and audaciously in control head of state addressed his nation and let it be known the State of the Union is strong. While I'll argue that point at some length. In full preacher mode, the president's oratory was, as the young folks say, on fleek.
Is that the expression?
I
that's how it goes. Yeah.
That's how they say, I think, on fleek. You know, just, I'm trying to be millennial. Work with me. But Obama began with, "I won't talk long," which, of course, is preacher speak for, "Get comfy. You going to be here about a spell." And Obama regaled the American people with his many triumphs, killing Osama bin Laden, passing the Affordable Care Act, and throwing down the gauntlet. When you come after Americans, we go after you. Friends, Americans, countrymen, and Martians, I had to declare side eye of the utmost right there. At no point did the president address the epidemic of police violence against unarmed citizens. But I became upset. The disclaimer started running through my head and right into my Twitter. I'm at JBay. If you come after Americans, we come after you. Not to include unarmed Black citizens gunned down by law enforcement. All the talk of STEM education and making America truly great and once more a leader in technology and innovation. Never once did President Obama say, "Hey, cops, quit killing unarmed Black children, for that might be the next Neil deGrasse Tyson or Mae Jemison." Anyhow, my sad and sorrowful side eye to our POTUS and his last term. But as I mentioned, I did find one bit of happiness to put into my side eye gratitude journal. Seems them good old Bundy boys fighting tyranny, as they like to say it, up at the bird rescue, they have been overwhelmed by generous packages. They're asking that folks concerned about their lack of snacks and activities, please send them no more adult toys in the shape of male genitals. They seem to be full up.
People are sending what?
Oh, yeah. Plenty of them.
Adult items.
Adult items in the shape of male genitalia and plenty of pornographic materials to inspire activities.
Since they might get lonely up there.
When it's cold outside.
We better move on, Amy. What do you have, Sada?
Well, you know, keeping with the theme of President Barack Obama's final State of the Union, I have a State of the Union side eye for the GOP rebuttal delivered by Governor Nikki Haley of the great
Nimrata.
State of South Carolina. And she, you know, I had to roll side eye. You know, nice try, Governor. I mean, on the one hand, she did manage to give the official GOP response without coming off like a complete incompetent. Because as we may remember, Marco Rubio and former Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal in recent years have given responses, and they became instant memes for their weird and unfortunate language and presentational components. But Governor Haley, you know, at the very least, she presented herself very well. She seems very measured. But she stuck to tried and true Republican talking points, especially in her efforts to sort of demonize President Obama. And she generally fell into the trick of fear-mongering that, as we know, is driving the narratives and the themes within the top presidential Republican candidates, including, obviously, Mr. Trump. And Ted Cruz is now buying into this whole fear-mongering narrative. So let's listen to a little tape of Governor Haley. Let's listen to a little bit of her.
As he did when he first ran for office, tonight President Obama spoke eloquently about grand things. He's at his best when he does that. Unfortunately, the president's record has often fallen far short of his soaring words. As he enters his final year in office, many Americans are still feeling the squeeze of an economy too weak to raise income levels. We're feeling a crushing national debt, a health care plan that has made insurance less affordable and doctors less available, and chaotic unrest in many of our cities. Even worse, we are facing the most dangerous terrorist threat our nation has seen since September 11th. And this president appears unwilling or unable to deal with it.
So that's the thing about Haley's response that drew heavy side eye from me. You know, she actually did show compassion after the disturbed racist white kid, you know, came into the church in South Carolina last summer and murdered nine black members of a Bible study class. You know, Haley pushed the state legislature down there to actually remove the flag of trees and the stars and bars from the alleged place of honor flying near the state house. However, as we just heard in that clip, you know, she's falling right into this fear-mongering. She went straight to referencing chaos in U.S. streets, which basically, you know, that's dog whistle, which translates to it's a not-too-veiled swipe at the Black Lives Matter and other protesters out here who are rightly fed up with these cops, as Jamila noted, out here gunning down unarmed, mostly Black and brown people. You know, and also in Haley's GOP response, she did take a veiled hit at Trump for his anti-immigrant hysteria, but she wrapped it in this cynical skein, you know, of playing to fears that appeal to these low information white GOP voters. You know, it's the tried and true narrative of, oh, I'm an immigrant person, I love me America because my family is not American and they taught me growing up, she's Indian American, that, you know, America is the greatest country in the world, however we have to keep immigrants out. So it's really cynical, you know, but because she wasn't, you know, she didn't make any obvious flubs, people are now out here comparing her to St. Ronald Reagan. Mm-hmm. You know, well, you know, I think she gets points for being a bit more sophisticated than Donald Trump, right? And certainly she's more appealing than that Bobby Jindal was. But it's very cynical, right, to play up I'm a poor immigrant story while you're also in the very same breath saying that, yes, we need to basically close our borders. Right. Mm. So, yeah. And, you know, she's been involved in enacting these draconian policies in South Carolina that effectively hurt poor people and working class people. So heavy side eye to Governor Haley. And we'll see what the next week brings.
All right. Thank you, Jamila and Amy. I have to say that, you know, Paul Ryan was giving some heavy side eye during the whole State of the Union address. I saw one of our co-hosts here at WPFW, Garland Nixon, he put up a post on Facebook where he put his coat or some kind of towel over that side of the TV. So he wouldn't see Paul Ryan sitting behind there, you know, like, yeah, making a screw face the whole time. And I have to give a little side eye to Hillary Clinton for bashing Bernie Sanders' health care plan. And I have to give a side eye to whoever is in charge of Bernie Sanders' appearance and makeup, because he got on one show and he looked crazy. I was like, you know, who was in charge of helping Bernie out with his appearance?
But people aren't going to vote for him based on his looks. And by the way, he was just endorsed by The Nation magazine.
He was. So.
Oh, Bernie.
Yes. Filling the burn.
They're filling the burn. Progressive pick.
So when we come back, it's 14 years and counting of indefinite detention and torture at the Guantanamo Bay prison, and activists are telling President Obama to shut it down. Stay with us.
Poem in reflection, in conversation, and in inspiration with the Witness Against Torture community, and specifically our recent trip to Guantanamo. At the time, the number reflected of men detained were 107, and it will be reflected in the poem. Fear and hate can manipulate the mind, and those that know will never show, but they'll work it in design. Behold the ignorance of the time. Get shot or get in line, get caught and drop a dime. A constitution's pretty, but your actions will define. It's like they don't believe that word and deed are intertwined. In Guantanamo, still detained are 107. From that number have been cleared 47, and their excuse for this abuse is still tied into 9/11. The hate feels powerful, trying to maintain their prominence. They enter the global stage with the greatest example of their incompetence. They invade the wrong country, imprison the wrong men, abuse every human right, and wonder why we can't get along then. The arc of justice is a long bend. Judge, jury, and torturer, they've taken this power upon them. So I focus my spirit and pick up a strong pen. But this is only a poem. They bomb the wrong targets and say it was only their homes. They lock our brothers up and hope it's unknown. We're calling Liberty, but she don't pick up the phone. They threw her in solitary, cause they don't think it's torture. They say she's only alone. A U.S. general testifies that Guantanamo prison makes the entire world unsafe. But a politician laughs in his face and says his words are mistakes. We trade world safety for political stakes. And you may wonder, why do I have a stake? Cause I've opened my eyes and seeing the world is displaced. Cause they've created the structures that leave our lives shattered. And the people who are the problem reply with, all lives matter. Their intentions are suspect, when they've never lifted a finger for justice. Their innocence is a new kind of avarice. They ignore millions of Syrians, but their hearts break for Paris. They deny those most in need of our amnesty, further pointing out the hypocrisy of their humanity, reserved only for the select few of the human family. That's why we are witnessing this torture. Pray and take a breath. Know the root of your success before you go and cash that check. Billions in debt, Black Americans still fighting for their breath, reciting, I can't breathe, while racists make jokes about their death. State violence is worldwide. We are witnessing where it connects in Guantanamo, where North Americans hide behind Cubans, where the U.S. military decides who is and isn't human. I was under the impression that this country was founded to do away with this oppression. But I've learned my lesson. These rights were never meant for a man of my complexion. So I put up a black fist, because bodega speak to me in Spanish and deli speak to me in Arabic. I am where humanity connects. I live where the Negro, Blanco, y Taino had met, which is to say, I see with my third eye and at the same time protect my neck. The road to justice is a marathon. And what we're asking for is a step. Abolish all torture and all unjust imprisonment. Only then will the darkness lift and we can finally wake to the truth. We are our greatest gift. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Emmanuel, for those powerful words. Building those connections between police brutality here in the United States, police murder, and the incarceration of so many people. And so we also say, not only shut down Guantanamo, but shut down solitary confinement. Shut it down. Shut it down!
Shut it down! Shut it down!
So I would like to invite Andy Worthington, a journalist, co-director of Save Shocker, and founder of the Close Guantanamo, to come up to the microphone.
Thank you, everybody. Hello from London.
Hello
from the We Stand With Shaka campaign.
Yeah.
And I believe that the giant plate full of Shaka armor is making its way around in front of the White House behind us. The real Shaka armor can't be here. But he is free from Guantanamo, finally.
Yeah!
And let me just briefly tell you how much work it was to get one man out of Guantanamo. Campaigners worked for years in Britain, standing as campaigners have done here, outside the White House, in Britain, outside our parliament, every week, in the rain, whatever the weather was like. We got MPs involved. MPs got other MPs involved. We had cross-party support for the release of Shaka Armour. We had major support from the mainstream media, including the most popular conservative tabloid in the UK, the Daily Mail. I set up this campaign in November 2014 with a friend, Joanne McInnes, based around the giant inflatable figure of Shaka Armour. We got over 100 celebrities and MPs to stand with Shaka Armour. All of this to put pressure on the man who lives in the White House to release one man from Guantanamo Bay. And yeah, finally it happened. What a success that was. But what an insane amount of effort to get one man out of that wretched place. Why was Shaka Armour held for so long? He was told 8 years before he was released that the US no longer wanted to hold him. That was under President Bush. He was told again under President Obama, after his task force reviewed all the prisoners' cases, that they didn't want to hold him, and still he was held. Shaka Armour is an extraordinarily eloquent and charismatic man. He has natural leadership abilities, and from the moment that he was apprehended in Afghanistan in late 2001, he fought against the Americans' betrayal of their values, their laws, and their treaties, and the ways that they treated people. And for that, he was regarded as a threat. There was never any evidence against him that was reliable at all that he posed any kind of terrorist or military threat to the United States. What it was that he was a leader of the prisoners, that he stood up to the ways that they were treated. And for that, there were people who year after year after year didn't want him free. Now, sure, some of those people deluded themselves into thinking that he was a bad man because of his charisma and his potential to lead, but it wasn't. It was simply because of the way that he stood up to them. Now, in the last few days, we've had prisoners released from Guantanamo. A man called Fayez Al-Kandari has been released to Kuwait, the last Kuwaiti in the prison. Similarly, years and years of the U.S. authorities trying to tell the world what a bad man he was. He went to the U.S., to Afghanistan about a month before the 9/11 attacks and was subsequently accused of becoming a spiritual advisor to Osama bin Laden in the space of about 3 weeks. Pack of lies against Fayez. You know what happened in his case? A bit like Shakarama. This is a man who wouldn't allow himself to be broken. So this is a man who was regarded as a threat because he wouldn't cooperate with them. A couple of days before that, just a few days ago, two Yemeni men were released from Guantanamo and given new homes in Ghana. That shows you how crazy the situation has become in Guantanamo. The U.S. government is shopping around for countries that will take Yemenis because the U.S. government won't send them home to their home country. These two guys, one of them was told under President Bush in 2005 that they didn't want to hold him. It took over 10 years to release him after he was told the U.S. didn't want to hold him. The other guy was told on Christmas Day 2006 that the U.S. didn't want to hold him. What country are we in where we have review processes to say to people, we don't want to hold you anymore, we're going to make the arrangements to release you, and yet people are held for 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years after that takes place and are not released? You know what dictatorships do when they throw you in a dungeon and throw away the key? They don't make any apologies. They don't tell you there's going to be a review process and that they're going to release you if you go through successfully, and then they don't release you, because that is the cruelest thing you can do to take away people's hope. The people in Guantanamo cheered the night that President Obama was elected president. It's 7 years later. We need President Obama to close Guantanamo. Now, we have over 40 people approved for release in Guantanamo who need to be released as soon as possible. Of the rest of the prisoners, there are 103 men now. Do you know how many are facing or have faced trials? 10. Do you know how many of the 779 men at Guantanamo who were held throughout the prison's history have faced trials? Altogether, 15. That's less than 2% of the prison population. Now, the rest of the guys, that's 49 guys there now. You read the papers and they will lazily tell you that these people are too dangerous to release. They're not.
Next, I want to invite Elizabeth Beavers from Amnesty International to speak the words of Mustafa Al-Hamsawi, a man currently held in Guantanamo. Hello.
Hi.
I'm honored to join all of you activists to commemorate what we hope and we pray will be the last anniversary of the detention and torture camp at Guantanamo Bay. I am inspired and motivated by the words of the detainees that have already been read and will continue to be read throughout these actions today. However, I join you all here today on behalf of Amnesty International USA to highlight one of the several detainees whose words we cannot read. As we campaign for the release of the cleared detainees, let us not permit ourselves, the public, or the U.S. government to forget the human rights abuses that are also being suffered by those detainees who have not yet been cleared, and yes, by those who are being subjected to the military commission's processes as well. Mustafa Al-Hamsawi, he is one of 10 individuals, as Andy mentioned, that are charged or convicted not before an independent court of law, but before the illegitimate military commission, which falls far short of international fair trial standards. He cannot tell us what it's like to face year after year after year of seemingly unending unfair trial. He cannot tell us about the very real possibility that he may face the death penalty after the conclusion of that unfair trial. So let me instead read for you the best source we have about Mr. Al-Hamsawi's treatment, which comes from last year's Senate report, the torture report. It tells us that Mustafa Al-Hamsawi was subjected to water dowsing that was indistinguishable from what we know as waterboarding, without approval from CIA headquarters. Both of the CIA interrogators involved in this incident reported that Mr. Al-Hamsawi cried out to God while the water was being poured on him. Mr. Al-Hamsawi was also subjected to rectal exams administered with excessive force. This torture led Mr. Al-Hisawi to be diagnosed with chronic hemorrhoids, an anal fissure, symptomatic rectal prolapse. More commonly, he has a torn rectum. This excruciating condition persists to this day, and it must be corrected by surgery. A surgery that he has consistently been denied, along with the other medical and psychiatric care required by any torture survivor. Let us continue to campaign for the protection of the rights of every single detainee who are entitled to those rights simply by virtue of their humanity. The rights against torture, against enforced disappearance, and against indefinite or arbitrary detention. I campaign for these rights today in the name of Mustafa Al-Hisawi, with the hope that President Obama will use this last chance to bring accountability for Mr. Al-Hisawi's torture and to end the unfair trial and indefinite detention that he and the rest continue to suffer. I urge you all today we are launching a global petition directed at the White House through whitehouse.gov. We need 100,000 signatures for the White House to respond. You can take out your phone now even and go to bit.ly/gitmoclose. Please sign it. Please join us today in this campaign to finally make this the last anniversary of Guantanamo. Thank you.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition on 89.3 WPFW Pacifica. I'm Esther Avaram, and you just heard voices outside the White House this week, part of a week of actions by Witness Against Torture to demand that President Obama close the Guantanamo Bay Prison and end the indefinite detention and torture there. Thank you to Chantel James for her reporting outside the White House. When we come back, we go to the Brooklyn neighborhood to hear authors and artists of a new book, When We Fight, We Win, about this century's social justice movements in this country. Stay with us.
Time is catching up on you, old slave driver. I know you see me stand my arms. So carry we go home, I bring we run a east. Well, I'm on a Rasta man, a Rasta no live on no chapter land.
Now on Tuesday night, the Brooklyn Busboys and Poets was packed for the book tour of When We Fight, We Win, 21st Century Movements and the Activists That Are Transforming Our World. We'll go to that event now, starting with the voice of Greg Jobin Leeds and ending with the co-authors Jorge Diaz and Demiri Hernandez of the art collective Agit Arte.
All right, so the title When We Fight, We Win was a rally cry first heard by Jorge Diaz, my other co-author, at the anti-eviction campaigns of City Life in Boston. Banks were foreclosing on homeowners, but City Life was able to keep many families in their home. City Life says we don't always win, but we win every time the right to fight, we win our humanity, and if you don't fight, we lose. When We Fight, We Win highlights what activists are doing to change the horrific police brutality and deep racism in this country. The U.S. used to be the world leader in high school graduation rates. Today, we're the world leader in jails. As an activist and a teacher for more than 30 years, I, like so many of you, have watched as things have gotten worse and worse. The leaders in When We Fight, We Win show us how to be better allies to those on the front lines of the struggle. And they show us how to speak out effectively and how to transform our society as we stand at this very scary but pivotal moment in history. When We Fight, We Win documents how U.S. immigration police are raiding homes in the dead of night. Children, the elderly, sent to deportation camps, families torn apart, deportations. It reminds me of my parents, my and my brother Dan here, who's here tonight, my parents watching relatives rounded up for deportation in Nazi Germany. I am alive and Dan is alive because some people spoke up, but not enough. Not enough people spoke out about the brutality then, and that's why that I know now to be silent is to collaborate. And what I have to say, we have to listen up and we have to speak out. When We Fight, We Win is filled with the voices of movement activists and artists and ordinary people who are not collaborating and who are making progress. One of them is Patrice Couillard-Brignac. She's founder of Black Lives Matter. Her brother was arrested and tortured in the LA jails. Starved and dehydrated, he had to drink the water out of his toilet bowl. Patrice tells the story of how she formed the LA Coalition to End Sheriff's Violence and how they won civilian oversight over the LA Sheriff's Department. When we fight,
we win.
When we fight,
we win.
This piece of art was done by Kevin Rashid Johnson. He's been in solitary confinement for 17 years, not seeing another soul for 23 hours a day. When we interview him, he has to write us his answers in pencil. His powerful art had became the symbol of the 30,000 California prisoners who went out on hunger strike. Patrice and others in the movement worked to spread their message, exposing the horrific use of solitary. And this year, the prisoners won a major policy victory in the chain and change in the broad use of policy, first in California and now in New York. When we fight,
we win.
While prison activists and Black Lives Matter work to create these changes, they put forth amazing, brilliant visions and show us how to get there. The movements of today are game-changing and interconnected. Steve Meacham, a movement organizer at City Life, helps lead successful campaigns to keep people in their homes. And they do it by creating eviction-free zones. How? With Ahitarte, my co-authors, they develop street theater and signs to tell their story, using lawyers' quarters and by building a human wall of hundreds of people. Standing in solidarity, they stop banks from foreclosing on people and families, and they keep them in their home, and they change local, state, and federal policy. This is one reason why at City Life, they declare when we fight, Paulina Helms Hernandez and Song, Southerners on New Ground, worked in North Carolina to stop an anti-queer defense of marriage bill. They lost. But while fighting, they worked with queer immigrant youth. And they told their stories about the horrors of the deportation camps and the widespread discrimination they faced. The Dreamers, as these young activists became known as, marched with T-shirts and that said, undocumented, unafraid. They defied the immigration police and they occupied President Obama's campaign office, Obama's re-election campaign office. And this is finally what gets the president to fulfill his earlier promises, his campaign promises. When you fight,
we win.
There are many other game-changing and interconnected movements in When We Fight, We Win. Indigenous groups blocking the tar sands and fracking. Occupy Wall Street, 350.org, the Chicago Teachers Union, the restaurant workers fighting for a livable wage, and many more. Together, these brave souls tell the story of today's transformation. I end with four of their qualities that make it so when we do fight, we do win. Number one, tell your story. Number two, transformation only comes with visions of transformation. Personal transformation, organizational transformation, cultural transformation, and political transformation. Okay, number three, work in solidarity. Connect your struggle and to others. We all need to listen up and speak out. And number four, disrupt the power. Change who has the power and how power is held. Because when we fight,
we win.
Thank you. Okay, so next up we have Jonathan Stitt from the Alliance for Educational Justice. Education is the movement that's closest to my heart and has been, and I've been a teacher, and I'm just so thrilled that Jonathan was able to be with us.
Thank you, Don. So I don't know if... So the story about Chicago is one of a myth's possibility. And I had the opportunity to work and walk with G2 Brown in that story. And I don't know if you've ever walked with a madman, and a madman who dares to invent a future. And every time G2 has an idea, he has a way of of Well Brothers and Sisters, and he gets us going. And then after the meeting, I'm always left with, well, how the hell are we going to pull this off? And so I walk into the story in 2012, although Chicago was the epicenter of massive privatization and school closings and state violence, it was also happening in New York City, Philadelphia, and Washington, D.C. And so part of our struggle, he got us, we were at a meeting, and he said, well, while we're here at this meeting, we need to go down downtown Chicago, an hour away, to drop off some Title VI complaints to the Department of Justice. And I said, how am I going to get 50 high school students to Chicago? And so we figured out a caravan of cabs, weaving through Chicago rush hour to get to deliver these letters. And from that, Journey for Justice was born, and this movement to fight school closings. Our work before then was around ending the school-to-prison pipeline and really understanding school discipline and the negative impact. And for us, our work has been now been, how do we understand the two? And so for us, the movement and the moment of Black Lives Matter offered us an opportunity to talk about state violence and to understand what's happening in our schools, both through school closings and the school-to-prison pipeline, as state violence, as government power that hurts, government power that harms, and that the education that young people of color are receiving in this country is an education that teaches them their place. And it's not lost that it's called the school-to-prison pipeline. And so where our work now moves forward is beginning to think about what next. And so for us and the young people and the folk who do it, we have this vision of education being for liberation. And so for us, the work that happened in Diet, the Diet hunger strikers, before there was the Diet 12, there was the Diet 13. And that was the 13 high school students who showed up to a school that was supposed to be closed demanding an education. We've also begun to understand what's happening in the United States as an international crisis, that we've linked with brothers and sisters in Brazil, as well as South Africa, to understand, again, what we are now calling educational colonialism, what we know as charters and privatization, is an international movement, and it will take us an international movement if we're going to liberate education. And then our last piece in bridging, what we also learned from the Movement for Black Lives Matter was the 1033 program. And I think this is where my request is that when we found out, Ferguson, that the guns and the tanks that the police department had, we found out that they had them in L.A., in the L.A. School Police Department, and that 25 other cities across the country are receiving government-grade weapons for schools. And so we begin to ask the question, if we're familiar with the history of Soweto in 76, we have to ask some very serious questions. Who are the guns for? Who are you planning on shooting? And so, and then we have to ask the same question to a federal government that denounces the school-to-prison pipeline but continues to fund it. And so we see students at the table arguing for $50 million for restorative justice while the same federal government gives $250 million for police and all the free guns that they want. And so if we are really going to liberate education, if black lives are to matter, if all of our lives are to matter, then our first step is calling on the federal government to end the 1033 program as police out of schools. Thank you. And when we fight...
My name is Jorge Diaz. I am the artistic director of Agitarte, and I'm also a founding member of Papel Machete, which is the radical street theater and puppetry group that they was referring to. We've been around for 10 years. We're based out of Santurce, Puerto Rico. That's where we do most of our work. And I say that also to say that we are a diaspora project. Agitarte has worked for almost 20 years working with communities of color, black and brown communities, in Puerto Rico and in the U.S., and building those bridges, understanding the importance of us as a colony to be able to build bridges with our oppressed folks here in the United States and build those relationships, which I think are very important. And I feel very honored to be around all these wonderful people that stepped up here who also belong to our frontline communities. And I want to specify that we're talking about frontline communities because a lot of people struggle. The right wing struggles as well. And a lot of times they seem to be winning. They fight and win too. So I want to be clear that we're talking about struggles against imperialism. We're talking about struggles against white supremacy. We're talking about struggles against patriarchy. And I say that because Greg had a great idea of calling this today the State of the Movement, as Obama gives his last speech. Which I will not forget, his inaugural speech. I usually don't listen to these things, but I was very he's a great speaker, and I wanted to see what he had to say and how, what a black president would say coming into office. I was really interested. And I, one line that I will never forget is one of his main lines, and it's like this typical U.S. president cowboy line. It was, "We will not apologize for our way of life." And as somebody from Puerto Rico, as somebody from a third world country, a colony of the U.S., that scared me. Because I knew that would mean, I'm sorry, I knew that that meant that we would continue on this path of war against our people. That we continue on this path of not having health care in this country. That we continue on this path of criminalizing our young black and brown men, boys and girls in our schools. And it would be also, we would continue this path of the prison industrial complex. I did not know at the time that it also fueled an extreme right-wing white supremacist groups and movement that now we have to battle. So today, I hear Obama, before his speech, he was talking about this idea of unity, that there's this unity in the U.S. And it's a very interesting subject, something we throw this word around of unity, where a lot of times our movements have not been about unity in the broad sense. It's been a unity of a couple folks, unity of organizers, unity of militant folks who are willing to take that chance and to shift the culture, to shift us away from this idea of that we have to continue this American way of life. So I invite folks, and I invite folks as a cultural worker, with another cultural worker next to me, and as you see the book, that we have a mission to try to shift this culture so that unity can mean a unity against imperialism, against white supremacy, against patriarchy, a unity that, for me, is in the best tradition of this country, of the wonderful people in this country that have fought for it. And I mean fought for the rights that we now take for granted, or fought for the things that we're losing, but that we're still here. And that when we build that unity on a shift of culture, then we can really get to a point where we can proclaim, where we can yell out in the best feeling of liberation and freedom. When we fight, we win. Cuando luchamos, ganamos.
Todo en la vida le fallará, Concepción eleva la vista al cielo. Como si el mundo se le cayera encima, Concepción contaba su desconsuelo. Y decía, hay niños que mantener. Y decía, hay niños que mantener. Si yo soy de los de abajo, ¿qué tiene que ver? Yo tengo el mismo derecho de vivir. Si yo soy de los de abajo, ¿qué tiene que ver? Yo tengo el mismo derecho de vivir.
As is every beginning life failed her, Concepción raises her gaze to the street protests where black lives matter to end white supremacy, because this is resistance. This is picture storytelling about a complex system industrialized in the lives of our people in prison. It's the prison industrial complex, or PIC, which feeds off people of color, or POC. Before the war on drugs got declared, there were about 250,000 inmates in the U.S. prison nation. Today, U.S. jails and prisons are filled with over 2.4 million people. Between 1970 and 2005, our prison nation increased 700%, with over 50% of our inmates in federal prisons in jail for drug offenses and 10% for immigration-related crimes. This means that these two categories of nonviolent crimes comprise over 60% of the federal prison population. We bring this quill to you as a challenge to common sense, to the idea we have grown up and lived with, that prison is the way to deal with crime, and the most affected by it, the poor. If all prisoners are counted, including juvenile, territorial, ICE, Native American country, and military, U.S. has around 25% of the world's prisoners, even though it only represents 5% of the world's population. Of the total population of inmates, blacks are incarcerated 5 times more than whites and Latinos, twice as likely. 80% of the incarcerated are low income, and nearly 40% of crime is attributed to poverty. More black men are in prison, or jail, or probation, or on parole than were enslaved in 1850. And that's why we ask, if all lives matter, because we're all created equal, why are some lives more equal than others? Since the 1970s and coincided with the drug war, harsh punitive policies, mandatory prison sentencing, and three strikes are out laws multiplied the prison nation of the U.S. Some would say this is good because criminals are behind bars. But if you look closely, the quilt reveals an economic system based on the needs of a chieftain market. Lucrative businesses that have turned surplus working class people into natural resources to feed a punitive, inhumane, capitalist system of correction by force. Roughly, 6% of state prisoners and 16% of federal prisoners are incarcerated by and work for private companies. The majority of employed prisoners are paid between 12 cents to 40 cents an hour. Prisoners have often been subjected to dangerous working conditions, such as being exposed to cadmium and lead while recycling electronics. GEO Group annual revenue is $1.2 billion. Corrections Corporations of America annual revenue is $1.7 billion with ICE contracts with some 15,000 vets in 14 facilities. These are 2 largest private prison corporations in the U.S.
Agüita de agonjolí, para los pobres soy, para los pobres soy. Y no me digan que no, porque con ellos estoy, donde quiera que voy.
Some would say prison labor helps inmates prepare for the labor market, but looking closely we see corporations taking advantage of prisoners. Even if inmates are employed, why do they have to be exploited, and why? Why not pay them a living wage since their families lose the income member of that family? The high cost of maintaining contact with family members in prison leads more than 1 in 3 families into debt. Which takes us back to our youth. American dreams of upward mobility are also common sense to us. If we study hard and work hard, we will be rewarded. We're supposed to be on an equal playing field in the lands of opportunity. But reality is far from this. Black and brown youth and the schools are being pipelined into prisons in the U.S. continues to have an excess of our people, not needed for manufacturing anymore. Funneled into service jobs that make it impossible to folks to even live in the neighborhoods where they grew up and lived. But some are not funneled. Even as they graduate and their schools close, they are targets to be policed, intervened under protocol to be murdered by the state with deadly force of less lethal weapons or full clips emptied onto our black and brown youth, adults, and elders.
Cuando yo salgo esta prisión que me tortura mi corazón, si sigo aquí, enloqueceré.
Kristen Taylor, Sandra Bland, Freddie Gray, Walter Scott, Tony Robinson, Anthony Hill, Akai Early, Victor Whiteberg, Tyree Woodson, Michael Brown, Excel Ford, Dante Parker, John Crawford III, Eric Garner, Yvette Smith, Jordan Baker, Ryan Stokes, Carlos Alcis, Jonathan Farrell, Kimani Gray, Kyan Lindenson, Miriam Carey, Dante Price, Dwayne Brown, Jersey Green, Johnny Kamai Warren, Justin Slip, Rekia Boyd, Raymond Allen, Ramari Brown, Melissa Williams, Kendrick McDade, Reynaldo Cuevas, Robert Dumas Jr., Chantel Davis, Cherie Francis, Sharma Edwards, Taman Robinson, Wendell Allen, Trayvon Martin, Tamia Rice. As if everything in life failed her, Concepcion raises her gaze to the street protests, where Black Lives Matter to end white supremacy, because this is resistance.
Those were voices from the D.C. stop of the multimedia book and art tour of When We Fight, We Win, 21st Century Movements and the Activists That Are Transforming Our World, published by the New Press. That was held Tuesday night at the Busboys and Poets Brookland location. And that will do it for us on Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I'm Esther Averam. Special thanks to Chantel James, Netfer Freeman, Jamila Bay, Amy Alexander, and our engineer, Mike Nasella, and also DJ Waheed for their contribution to today's show. You can reach us at onthegroundshow.org, and you can like us on Facebook and Twitter at On the Ground Show. Now stay tuned for the news, followed by Krista Property on the Thursday edition of Don't Forget the Blues. Raise your voice out there. Peace.